good evening, and welcome back to the best in overnight talk radio. Coast to Coast AM is on the air. I'm Dave Schrader. Tonight, a look at the dark side of Bigfoot encounters. And just in time, here's a story hot off the headlines from just a few days ago. Northwest Territories man tells of an encounter with the Naga, the Tlichu Sasquatch, following a boating accident. A man who spent 2 days alone on an island after capsizing his canoe says he had a terrifying encounter with a mythical creature. And in the Northwest Territories Tlichu region, he's not the first. On July 17th, after boating hours from Wati to the most northern tip of Lac La Muerte, 42-year-old Tony Willa spotted some garbage in the water ahead of him, a plastic bag bobbing in the waves. Willa slowly brought his boat up beside it. He reached in to get it, but just as he did, a wave rocked the boat and he fell over the side and into the frigid water. He struggled to pull himself back into the boat, but his clothes, heavy with the weight of the water, kept pulling him down. He grabbed a plastic bag of supplies and began the long, tiring swim back to shore. "I managed to swim to an island at the end of the point," Willa told the CBC in Tlicho in his Yellowknife hospital room last week. He says that that's when he encountered the Bushman. "All of a sudden, there was a big man standing beside me," he said. "He must have walked away because I heard some branches break throughout the bushes. I packed up my clothes in the white bag and readied myself to leave." Willa swam away from the island and would spend another 48 hours alone in the wilderness. When he was rescued by the RCMP and Canadian military, he would tell the story of his encounter with a Bushman to whoever would listen. "Beings with powerful magic." For many in the Tlicho region, the presence of Bushmen, or Naga as they are known in the, and I'm butchering this name, I apologize, Tlicho language, is a reality that goes back thousands of years. It's a terrifying, human-like creature known for stealing people from the bush camps. Tlicho columnist John B. Zoe described them in 2010 in the Northwest Territories News. "Generally, they are silent. And for the unfortunate few who have seen them, these symptoms can be experienced. The back of the neck will tingle. Skin will break into goosebumps. Unstoppable shivers begin, and the heart beats faster, accompanied by shortness of breath," Zoe wrote. Tlicho elder Michael Lewis Rebeska learned about the Naga when he was a boy living in the bush with his parents. "I got the story from my grandma because my grandma lived in the bush all the time," Rebeska says. Rebeska says a Tlicho people and Naga have lived in the same region since time immemorial. He says the Naga look just like human beings and even sometimes wear modern clothes, but he says the Naga have powerful magic. They lure people towards them, stealing them, never to be seen again. There's even stories of the Naga stealing moose and caribou carcasses. Rebeska says that when he was little, his grandmother told him a story about one of the relatives who encountered a Naga and was never seen again. They just took him. In that case, the Naga appeared suddenly on an island. They used medicine power to push him into the shore. They did it. They took him, Rebeska says. So we never saw him, never heard from him again. Some people heard him talking and screaming help, but nobody could do anything. Now, nearly a century later, Rebeska had his own encounter with the Naga while driving toward the Frank Channel Bridge between Ray and Edzo one morning decades ago. He says he saw a man standing in the middle of the narrow bridge. Rebeska slowed down as he approached the man, and then all of a sudden, the man jumped over the side. Rebeska hurried out of his vehicle to look over the side to see if the man was okay, but there was no one there. "I didn't see him. I don't know what happened to him." Rebeska says he's done his best to collect and pass on stories of the Naga to the next generation. He said that as the development pushes people further into the bush, interactions with these Bushmen or Sasquatch will only increase. That's just one encounter, and again, just from recently here in Canada. When we come back, Jim Bear King and Tim Kunbo Baker, the Bigfoot Outlaws, visit to share their strange encounters and many more that they've collected through the years of dark encounters with Sasquatch. We'll do that here on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back here on Coast to Coast AM. Joining us for the remainder of the show, the Bigfoot Outlaws are here. We're going to talk about more dark encounters with the Bigfoot. Let's begin by introducing Jim King, also known by his friends as the name Bear. He had his first Bigfoot encounter in 1966, not knowing what it was at the time, and it wasn't until 1972 that he became aware of Bigfoot and has been studying the subject ever since. Jim, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us this evening.
It's good to talk to you again, Dave. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. And do you prefer Jim, Bear? What would you like us to call you tonight?
I'll let my friends call me Bear. And I hope that the listening audience will accept that, because I answer the Bear more regularly than I do anything else, even though my mother hates it.
All right, Bear. Well, talk to me, if you will. Your first sighting was in 1966. Now, had you had any awareness of the Bigfoot or Sasquatch culture or myth at all before your first encounter?
No, sir. I was all of 6 years old, and my mother and father had just separated. They was going through a heated divorce. The reason I remember the time and the year was due to the fact that my sister wasn't but about 6 weeks old when my father left the house. And my mother was really upset over my father leaving, but she wouldn't allow me and my younger brother to witness her going through the pain of and suffering of being abandoned by her husband. So she'd do most of her crying in her own bedroom at night, where she also had my newborn baby sister. Me and my brother, we stayed in a bedroom on the eastern side of the house. Like I said, in 1960, we did not have an air conditioner. So we would put a regular fan in the window in the dining room, and we would open up all the windows in the house so the air would circulate through the house. I do know that she was born in July, so 6 weeks old, this had to be mid-August. That's how I remember the time. I know that me and my brother was asleep. Our bedroom was on the western wall, whereas at the foot of the bed, there was a window that was looking out on the backside of our property. And we had, as I mentioned before, the windows open so the air could blow through it, and it'd be moderate temperature in the house. I don't know how late it was at night. I was 6 years old. Something woke me up through the night, sometime during the night. And we didn't have no night light in the room, so my eyes was able to pick up the ambient light that was outside. I can't remember the moon stage, but I do know that I could physically see out the bedroom window. Whatever was making the noise that woke me up was just outside the bedroom window. Within about 15 yards away from the bedroom window, the ground on the backside of the property sloped upward. Well, we had my grandfather give my dad and mom 1 acre of land to build the house on, so we had to fence the house in because my grandfather had cattle and horses roaming freely on his property. Whatever it was a sound going,
so you could tell it wasn't like a hoot owl, because then you would pick up the clicking and clacking and tacking noises that it was adding as well.
Right.
Okay.
Right. It was so strange that it just woke me up. It did not even wake my brother up. And I guess it was a good thing it did not at that given moment, because I'll explain that in a minute or two. But when I noticed the sound was coming from outside, I just raised up in the bed and looked toward the window, which, as I stated earlier, was at the foot of the bed. And out on draped over a 4-strand barbed wire fence, with both of its arms draped over the top wire of the fence, there was this, and this, the only thing I could equate it to, was a large ape or a monkey slowly swaying back and forth. Its head was going slowly to the right, slowly to the left, and I equate the calling or the noise it was making as cooing towards me and clacking its teeth or whatever, or smacking its lips. I couldn't tell which it was doing. As I said, it was in the dark. But I could see the form of this thing. It was slowly swaying on top of this fence. It was dark color because it was draped over the fence. Both of its arms were over the top wire, and it was slowly swaying back and forth, to the right, to the left, going, well, of course, when I seen it, it blew my mind. The first thing I did was immediately wake my brother up because I wanted him to see what was outside our bedroom window.
Now, were you getting, just out of curiosity, were you getting any kind of physical sensation from seeing this? I mean, was it putting fear in you to see this, or were you just more filled with wonder and awe of trying to figure out what was going on and what this thing was?
The best description I can come up with, Dave, was wonder and awe. I was not scared per se, but I was, what in the hell is this? At 6 years of age, you know?
Right.
And it blew my mind. And
sure.
I wanted to share this with my brother because I couldn't really believe what I was looking at. And so I immediately woke my brother up. And when I did, you have to understand, my brother was one of those types that when he saw something he didn't like, he was gone. I mean, he left. He didn't care who he was leaving behind in the dust or whatever. He was gone. He glanced out the window, saw what I was seeing, heard what I was seeing, comprehended, I guess, or, you know, it all clicked with him. But you also got to remember, I was six. He was had to have been all of four going on to 5 years of age.
Right.
And he saw this thing, and he got the hell gone. Well, when he got the hell gone, you know, fear is infectious, very much so.
Right.
So he left me behind, and that wasn't happening. I was right on his heels. He ran across the hallway to the western end of the house where my mother's bedroom was. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, my mom was not asleep. She was actually crying or sniffling, and you could tell she had been crying. And, of course, my brother, he didn't even hit the brakes until he dove up into the bed with her. And, you know, that really disturbed her. Well, immediately here I come right on his heels, and I'm diving on top of both of them. And Mom started trying to get us to calm down. What is it? What is it? Of course, my brother said, Mama, there's a monkey outside our window. There's a big monkey outside our window. And somehow or another, we woke my sister up. She started crying the whole nine yards. And it was kind of pandemonium during the course of all this. I remember that my mama calmed me and my brother down. She said something to the effect, boys, there's no such thing as a monkey in the state of Mississippi. That's wild. You know, you only see them on TV or at the zoo.
Right.
And then, see, I do remember out of all of that,
mm-hmm.
never got out of bed to go and look and see if there was a monkey outside our bedroom window.
Sure.
Which I guess I couldn't blame her, but, you know.
No, I mean, that's, you know, you might just think, oh, my kids are being goofy or they had a bad dream, and that was probably it. Or more importantly, you know, as a parent, you also have to ask that question, do I want to really have to go look and then try to explain what the heck it really is?
This is true. Right. You know, you'd have to remember, Mom wasn't but about 23, 24 years old at the time, and
mm-hmm.
you know, the man of the house was not there anymore. The baby was crying. Here we was hysterically in the bed trying to get as deep under the covers as we could get, and it just ended up being a wild night early on, and after that, things just calmed on down.
All right, and that was your first encounter seeing, and what you guys have an interesting nickname for the Bigfoot in your area. What do you guys call them?
Oh, yeah, I was listening to you earlier calling them Nachos up there, the Bushmen in Alaska.
Right.
Down in the South, we got another name for them, another moniker, as we call it. Everybody calls them boogers. We got that saying when we, I mean, I've been a lot of places across the South, even as a child, and your parents would always stand on the back porch, y'all get your butts in the house or a booger's going to get you. Or, and here's what the strange thing about this is, through all my research, when people order a halogen outside light for their driveway, especially people who live in rural communities or out in the country or whatever, and they want the outside light, when they call the electric company to install this light, here's how they order. They always will order, I want a booger light for my backyard. And it just became, booger was a name in the South used. I say a lot on the radio show that I understand what, you know, Sasquatch and Bigfoot and all that, especially later on in life. That's a funny story in and of itself. But all we ever knew these things were called were boogers. If you didn't know or understand what was going on around you, it was a booger making that racket. I've heard them say, I'd hear these things scream on top of the hill behind the house. We had to eventually move in with my grandparents because my mom couldn't afford the house payments on the house that I was as a six-year-old child. And after the divorce became final, we moved in with my grandparents. Well, we would hear things on the back of the hill on our property, even up until before I had the second encounter with these things. And I'd say, what is that? And my grandfather looked over me and just say, oh, that's just one of them damn boogers up there on the hill. And, you know, booger just becomes synonymous with what these things was, especially in the South. And
But your grandfather just talked about it matter-of-factly, like, you know, we might hear in Minnesota of, oh, that's just a moose or that's just a deer out there. So
I mean, there was no hesitation on his part when he mentioned it, and he wasn't the only one. I'd hear people in church speak of boogers and things like this, but, you know, we just assumed, you know, it was something regular in life.
All right. You've got kind of this natural-born acceptance in the area of these creatures. Did you ever press your family for deeper information of what they were? Were they human? Were they animal? Were they ghost? What kind of information did you understand about the booger, the woolly boogers down there?
Well, the second encounter, the one probably in 1972, me and my brother and my sister, I can't for sure say it was 72. I'm thinking it was 70, 71, or 72. You
got okay, we got about a minute and a half here to go with this story, so I don't want to rush you, but I want you to know what you got going.
All right. It's going to take a minute or two, so we'll stretch that out a little after you either introduce Kumbo or whatever, because we've got plenty of time tonight. I picked at you last time we did a show that we didn't have enough time, remember?
Yeah, we'll have plenty of time tonight with all of the different encounters. We'll hear more about your second encounter with the infamous woolly boogers down south and the beasts that you're able to gather. And just out of curiosity, when did you start gathering the stories of the dark side of Bigfoot, or was it just that more and more of the encounters just seemed to be getting more aggressive in nature?
It became more synonymous with the fact that when we found out these things, what they was doing to our cattle and particularly our horses. But at that point in time, we did not have a clue that this was caused by these things we called boogers. Mm-hmm. We just, you know, assumed certain things that we would find on our livestock would be natural occurrences. And they still are natural occurrences. But then we had a neighbor at the time was the one that revealed to us that it was more than just natural occurrences. And then all of the evidence came together to prove this to us. And we'll get into that a little later, too, after you take a break.
All right, we'll take a break. Tim Kumbo Baker joins us next. The Bigfoot Outlaws and the Darker Side of Bigfoot. That's our topic tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the show. We've got the Bigfoot Outlaws tonight here on Coast to Coast AM. Let's now talk with Tim Coonbo Baker. He is one that is never short of stories when it comes to Bigfoot. And Tim claims to have had Bigfoot on his property and has researched them in numerous states. Tim has been studying this phenomenon nearly all his life. His stories, never ending and entertaining to say the least. Tim Coonbo Baker, our guest now, will join Jim Bear King. All right, Coonbo, welcome to the show. Let's talk a little bit about your first encounter with Bigfoot and Sasquatch. What age were you, and what got you involved in this?
First time I ever actually heard anything, or you know, that I remember that was attributed to Bigfoot. And by the way, there were some of the folks over where I was from in Northwest Alabama that called them that boogers, but they also called them other things. My dad and my grandfather called them catamounts, which a lot of people call cougars catamounts, but they're around our area of East Colbert County, Alabama. There were quite a number of people called, you know, Sasquatch or you know, Bigfoot catamounts. Of course, we had never heard the word Sasquatch or Bigfoot at that time. And this was back in the late 1950s. And I was around 3 years old or so, and one evening we were outside playing around. We had on our farm, there was us and, you know, my mom and my dad and my sister and my second brother hadn't been born at this time yet, and lived there on the farm, plus my grandparents in another house, plus we had another family that lived down in the bottom, about a quarter mile away, and then right over next to my grandparents' house, there was a family that sort of ran the farm. Mr. Terry ran the farm for my dad, and then right near them was a family that ran our sawmill, and they were woodcutters plus sawmillers, and everybody had kids. We all, you know, played around outside, and we were playing around out there one evening, and it was, you know, getting along dusky dark or so, and down in the lane there north of the house, north of my grandparents' house, heard all this, you know, loud screaming and yelling started down there, and, you know, got everybody's attention. I mean, it was really loud. I mean, I had, of course, I was only 3 years old, but I still remember how loud it was, you know, and I can remember, you know, the woodcutters, one of them said, you know, what in the hell is that? And my grandfather just casually said, "Ah, it's just that old catamount down there. Don't worry about it." And anyway, it screamed several more times, and it sounded like it was getting a little closer. Well, yeah, I didn't really think anything of it at the time, but, you know, the mothers started coming out there and gathering up kids, getting us all in the house, you know, into our various houses. And we lived about halfway across a 40-acre field, you know, 300 or 400 yards to the south of there. And our house was furthest to the south. And the thing was out to the north of my grandparents' house a good ways. Well, we were over there, you know, I was back at my house, and I could still hear the thing yelling. I mean, and this thing was probably 500-600 yards away, and it was still quite loud, you know, and sort of like what Bear said, we didn't have air conditioning back then, and everybody slept with their windows open. After we went to bed that night, I'm laying there in the bed, and I can hear it over there still occasionally yelling. And then I noticed I could tell that it was getting closer. Well, the Hudsons, who were the sawmillers and woodcutters, they had about seven big old coon hounds. And I mean, they were rough ones too. They were plot hounds, and I think they had a couple of Catahoulas and maybe some walkers, but these are really gamey dogs. I mean, these are rough, tough old dogs. And just as is typical out in the country, you know, they lived, laid around up under the house or up on the front porch or whatever. Well, they all started barking and raising holy hell. And the thing hollered again, and we heard them all. You could hear them all bail out and go running off down the lane to the north towards the noise. And you know,
now Kunbo, can you explain to me this cry, this yell that it was doing?
It was a very extremely loud, very deep roar. It was almost like the roar of a lion, but it was covered a wider frequency range. There was a sort of a high pitched part of it too, but the part that struck me was there was a very deep resonating component to it also, and I can't even begin to imitate it. But having heard it quite a few times since in an adult life, it will actually rattle your chest and rattle your clothes if you're within, you know, if you're within 150 yards of the thing. It's like if you're standing on the sidewalk and a band is coming by, and how it shakes and rattles you. And I believe that part of that has to do with there's an infrasound, or, you know, very low frequency, you know, below 20 hertz component of that roar. But it is nothing like it is. Anybody that ever heard it would never confuse it with a cougar roaring or squalling or a bobcat or anything like that. This is totally unlike that. But anyway, the dogs go tearing off. And in just a minute, we hear the dog start shrieking and hollering and yelling, and obviously in pain. They are coming back to the house.
Mm-hmm.
We hear the thing roar another time or two, coming towards the house, closer. And then this ungodly fight breaks out. There's apparently a few of them that, you know, they're going to stand their ground once it gets close enough to the house. And there's a hellacious fight. And I can remember my dad grabbed a shotgun and took off over there. But before he could get over there, my grandfather had come out of the house, and I heard him over there shooting his 30-30. And I don't know if he was shooting up the air. I don't know if he was shooting at the catamount, as he called him. I don't know what happened. You know, my mother got us all, my sister and I, and we got us into the bedroom with her, and closed the windows, and got us into bed where we couldn't hear what was really going on. And there were a few more shots, and then things got quiet. After a bit, my dad came back and came back to the house. Next morning, we get up. The Hudsons had packed up lock, stock, and barrel and left during the night, never, ever to come back. They packed up and left in the middle of the night. Also, the next morning, there were at least, I don't remember if all of them were dead, but there were at least five of those dogs torn to shreds, dead. And when I mean torn to shreds, I mean pulled apart. Legs pulled off. Heads twisted around backwards, some of them pulled off, their bodies twisted. I mean, just unbelievable mutilation. Nothing like what you would see if a bear or a cougar or something like that got a hold of it.
To you, though, that this kind of attack is going on and the family's like, we're packing up during the battle, we're getting out of here? I would have been in the basement shivering.
My grandfather, the shooting and stuff that my grandfather did, ran it off, and it shut up and it ran off when my grandfather started shooting, and it was after that that they you know started packing up, and my dad found out later my dad tried to talk them out of it, but hell no, get out of my way.
They wanted out of there, right?
They wanted out of there, and they left. And like I said, there were these there and there. They were left all these dead dogs, and I don't know if they took even one of them with them. I can't remember that, but I know that there were a minimum of five pulled apart, torn apart, dead dogs that were left behind.
Now, when they were shooting, were they trying to shoot at the creature to kill it? Or were they just shooting to scare it off?
Don't know. My dad and grandfather were really closed mouthed about that. And like I said, we were in our house, about 300 yards away from where this happened. And we could hear it clearly because all the windows were open, and it was, you know, a very still night, but I didn't see it. And my dad never, ever would talk about it. And although just a little, he would talk just a little bit on occasion, but I remember I asked my grandfather, in fact, he took me back just a day or two after this. I don't know where my dad and my mom were, but I was, my grandfather was sort of not really babysitting me, but he was just hauling me around wherever he went out on the farm. And we rode back towards the sawmill, and there's a big oak tree out in one of our fields that sits, and it's about 350 to 400 yards away from there, from my grandparents' house. And he pulled up in the truck and he pointed at that tree, and he never ever called me by my name. He always called me boy. He said, "You see that tree right there, boy?" "Yes, sir." And he said, "Those catamounts sit up in that tree and they watch us. Don't you ever come back here around this tree by yourself." And he said, "Every time I come back here, they jump down out of that tree and run off down in that holler there." And he was dead serious. My grandfather was not a joke around, fool around guy. And he was dead damn serious. And I asked him, I said, "Granddad, what is a catamount?" And he said, "Well, I guess it's sort of like a cross between a great big monkey and a bear." And he said, "I don't know what it is." He said, "That's best I can describe it." Which, for 1958, that was a pretty good description.
Yeah.
You know, considering that, you know, the Gimlin Patterson film hadn't come out, you know, Natural Geographic hadn't had any specials on about the Yeti or Abominable Snowman or anything. That was a pretty good description. Well, later I asked my dad, I said, "Daddy, you know, what's a catamount?" He said, "Well, I don't know exactly, son, but it's sort of a cross between maybe a bear and a big gorilla, and maybe the way they climb, there might be some cat in them too. I don't know, you know." And and which, again, pretty close to what my dad described, and just pretty close to what my grandfather described. So that's pretty good description. But you know, over the years, you know, we would still occasionally hear the things back there, but we never had another incident growing up where they came up close to the house like that. Although, you know, we would hear things happen with the neighbors and stuff. And an interesting thing, an area that's even on the topographic maps just to the northeast of southeast of our farm, it's called Booger Bottoms. And it turns out it's right in the main travel route for the boogers when they move through the area during the season changes, you know, around in the spring and in the fall. But the next time I had an encounter with them was after I was out of college. And while I was in college,
So between that experience, mm-hmm, all the way till college, had you seen another one?
No.
Or only
no.
heard the distant
no.
cries?
I had an incident happen one time, I guess when I was about five or six, where it's one of those things that I don't know if it was, you know, for real or not, where I had a thing happen similar to what Bear described. I heard something outside my bedroom window, and I looked out the window, didn't see anything, and then I heard a little noise, and I leaned out the window and turned my head to the left, and there was one pressed with his back up against the wall of our house, and he had his head turned, and he's looking right at me. And when I looked at him, he sort of bared his teeth at me, and I don't know if it was if he was, you know, growling at me, or if it was, you know, sort of an attempt at a smile or what. But I had nightmares about that for
ages, for years and years and years. And but you know, there was it, when I think back on it, I can't really remember 100% for sure if it was, you know, if it actually happened, or if it was something that was a reaction to all the other crap that went on around out there. And I used to hear about, we used to hear about them coming up around other, some of the neighbors' houses and looking in windows and stuff like that. And had neighbors down the road from us that they called it the Goat Man, and because it stunk so bad, and it came up, looked in their windows several times. And but now that's another story. But I mean, after I got out of college, I moved out onto the farm. My grandparents had both passed on, and the farmhouse, was, the old home place, was sitting there empty at the time. So I moved out there. I was working in the electrical engineering department of a local utility. And I'd been living out there for not very long at all. I started hearing the same old screams and stuff back over in the woods. And, you know, I'm thinking, I hope they stay back there. I don't want anything going on up here. And I had a big Doberman pincher at the time. And I mean, he was a pretty good size, and he weighed about 90 pounds. And we had had some problems with some cattle disappearing off the back of the farm. And so I had taken to, we thought somebody was rustling our cattle. And so I had taken to getting my deer rifle and my dog, and would slip back over there long about dark, and would sit back up on a ridge over on the back of the farm, just with my eyes and my ears open, listening.
We've got about a minute and a half left here.
Yeah. Just listening. And one night I was walking back to the house, and my dog started whining and looking back over its left shoulder. And about that time, I started getting a really bad creepy feeling. My skin started crawling, and my goosebumps and everything, to the point, and I felt like I was in imminent danger. I clicked the safety off of my rifle. At that instant, the thing cut loose and screamed at me from about 30 yards away. And I mean, it about blew the hat off my head. Unbelievable how it shook my body and everything. Instant gut reaction, I broke to my right and started hauling ass running across the field to the south. My dog passed me. He never broke stride. He ran straight to the house. I ran about 150 yards, suddenly realized that I don't need to be running away from something that might be chasing me. I whirled around with my rifle up and the safety off, finger on the trigger, and the thing was still screaming, but it was in the edge of the woods, and it was stomping back and forth and shaking trees and screaming at me. All I got was just glimpses of it. The next night, it showed up at the house. It followed me home.
All right, we're going to have to stop you there. We got to stop you there. We'll find out what happens when the Bigfoot follows him home. Tim Kunbo Baker, Jim Bear King, the Bigfoot Outlaws on Dark Encounters with Sasquatch continues here on Coast to Coast AM.